everyone. Thank you for joining us. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has officially confirmed that its media relations chief was assassinated in an Israeli airstrike on central Beirut. Hezbollah praised Mohammad Afif's courage in confronting the Israeli media machine and conveying the voice of the resistance and its positions. The movement said Afif clearly outlined the features of the ongoing war by his live appearances in Beirut's southern suburbs, which have been the focal point of the Israeli bombardment of the Lebanese capital. Hezbollah added that Afif's brave positions instilled fear in the hearts of the enemy. The Israeli strike on Sunday targeted a building in Beirut's Ras al-Naba'a district, resulting in the killing of Hezbollah media relations chief. Now, reactions keep pouring in following the Israeli assassination of Mohammad Afif, the head of Hezbollah's media office, in a targeted airstrike on Beirut. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has condemned the assassination of Afif as an aggressive and terrorist act. Ismail Baghaei called the killing yet another sign of the regime's inhuman nature and an attempt to silence those exposing his crimes in Palestine and Lebanon. Palestinian resistance movements have deplored the assassination in separate statements, with Hamas calling it a treacherous and heinous crime. While condoling the martyrdom of Afif and his colleagues, Hamas also said that the killing of media figures cannot silence the voice of the resistance. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said the assassination is the continuation of Israel's approach to bloodshed in Lebanon and Palestine in violation of all humanitarian laws. The Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggression against Lebanon, leaving more civilians dead and injured in its latest attacks. Nearly a dozen people were killed and over 40 others wounded in a strike on Lebanon's Tyre region. A separate attack on Beirut's Ras al-Naba'a neighborhood causes fatalities. Israeli warplanes also bombed the Mar Elias neighborhood in central Beirut, resulting in casualties amongst the displaced people. The Israeli military says it struck over 200 targets in Lebanon since Saturday. That has prompted Lebanon's education ministry to close schools and higher education institutions in the Beirut area for the next 2 days. The Israeli aggression against Lebanon has so far claimed the lives of nearly 3,500 people and injured over 14,000 others since October last year. Thus, while Hezbollah has fired more projectiles and drones towards Israeli targets in retaliation for the regime's ongoing aggression against Lebanon and the genocide in Gaza, a barrage of rockets hit the Kiryat area north of the Israeli-occupied city of Haifa. Another rocket targeted a gathering of Israeli forces in the Ramin barracks in the northern occupied Palestinian territories. Hezbollah also targeted some other gatherings of the regime's troops in several towns in southern Lebanon. A Merkava tank was struck with a guided missile in southern Lebanon as well. The tank was destroyed and its crew members were killed and injured. Israel's Ma'ale Golani barracks in the occupied Golan Heights was targeted too. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier with a recap of Hezbollah's anti-Israeli operations. Let's take a listen.
Hezbollah has been clear in continuing its retaliatory operations, in addition to the operations that are stopping the Israeli forces from the incursions, from infiltrating Lebanese territory to a manner where they can take hold of the whole town. Now we see that one of the main areas of focus for Hezbollah was in Khiyam, because it seems that the Israelis are attempting a new incursion in the southern parts of Khiyam as well as the eastern parts of Khiyam. Hezbollah said they targeted the Israeli forces in the south of Khiyam 8 times today with several rockets, with a barrage of rockets. They also launched a UAV fleet, bomb-laden UAVs, towards the eastern part of Khiyam against the Israeli forces in that area specifically. And in addition to those, Hezbollah declared that they were able to strike and destroy a Merkava tank in the Tar Harpa Jabain area, which is also close to the town of Shama, which was another scene of confrontations between Hezbollah's resistance and the Israeli forces. Hezbollah said that in Shama, they not only targeted an Israeli force, but they also targeted a Merkava tank as well, We also had several attacks on the Ramin barracks. There was an ambush.
Death and destruction have become common occurrences in Gaza as the Israeli military keeps pounding the blockade of Palestinian territory relentlessly with air and artillery strikes. In one of the attacks, Israeli warplanes bombed a group of civilians in the Tel al-Hawa neighborhood southwest of Gaza, killing at least four and injuring several others. Several Palestinians were also killed after Israeli jets targeted two homes in the Abu Raj and Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza. The Israeli shelling of Gizan and Najjar village near the southern city of Khan Yunis also caused a number of fatalities. This is while on Sunday, a strike on a building in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, killed over 70 Palestinians, mostly women and children. The Israeli aggression against Gaza began in October last year. Since then, more than 43,800 people have been killed and nearly 103,800 others injured. We earlier talked to a Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabbeh, who provided us with further details regarding the Israeli strikes across Gaza. Let's take a listen.
Here in the middle area of Gaza Strip, as you know, 24 Palestinian civilians have been confirmed killed in the eastern part of Al Buraj refugee camp after the Israeli occupation forces embarked on carrying out a swift ground offensive against the eastern part of Al Buraj refugee camp. An entire residential square was completely wiped out and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces, leaving this kind of high number of the Palestinian casualties. The situation is still catastrophic in the middle area of Gaza Strip because the Israeli occupation forces are still decimating the northern part of Al Buraj refugee camp and Nusrat refugee camp as well. Those areas are still attacked by the Israeli artillery shelling intensely. On the ground, the Israeli occupation forces also continue to dynamite and destroy more residential buildings and square. Several massive explosions actually boomed in the northern part of the middle area of Gaza Strip following those constant attacks by the Israeli occupation forces. And till now, as we speak right now, the Israeli fighter drones are still flying at low levels and altitudes, which means clearly that more horrific attacks to be committed and carried out by the Israeli occupation forces against the middle area of Gaza Strip. The current situation is still escalating spirally in the middle area of Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, as you know, multiple attacks were carried out against Khan Yunis city in the southern part of Gaza Strip, whereas the fresh attack took place in Gizan and Najjar when the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people, killing at least six Palestinian civilians.
Now to the occupied West Bank, where the Israeli regime's forces have raided several towns and refugee camps once again. In Jenin, soldiers detained Palestinians after blocking the main road leading to the refugee camp. Meanwhile, the regime's forces demolished Palestinian homes in the towns of Silwan and Aram. Settlers backed by troops also attacked and injured several Palestinians. Our correspondent Nikar Hamad joined us earlier from Ramallah with the details.
Not only homes were demolished in Silwan and in Aram area, but also more than 40 Palestinian homes have received demolishing notices from the Israeli regime, informing them that they will be destroying and demolishing their homes anytime in the upcoming months. The Palestinian Prisoners Club has announced that the IOF in the last 12 hours have arrested more than 18 Palestinians. And now, as we speak, an ongoing raid on the village of Jaba near Jenin And this Jenin its area and its surrounding is being raided continuously as since the beginning of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Jenin has endured a lot of military pressure and, of course, the entire West Bank, but especially into the northern cities of the West Bank, Jenin, Tubas, Nablus, and Tulkarem have endured so much during these last 14 months. And in the raid that is going on in Jabah, in near Jenin, local sources have told us that the IOF is using tear gas bombs and shooting around.
Ivana strongly condemned the UK's denial of the ongoing genocide in Gaza, branding it as outrageous. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said the denial of the Gaza genocide is simply in line with the UK policy of persistent provision of lethal weapons and political support to the apartheid Israeli regime. Baghaei added that the denial also makes the UK complicit in the carnage unfolding in Gaza. The spokesman noted that the Gaza genocide is extremely appalling and a reminiscence of deeply rooted colonial mentality that is dangerously coming to the fore in Europe through systemic anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia. Earlier this month, UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy denied classifying the events in Gaza as genocide. Journalist and commentator Robert Fantina joined us earlier with his take on UK's denial of the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza.
This is genocide. How anyone can deny it? The factors that you mentioned, starving people, killing innocent men, women, and children, babies, infants, toddlers, anyone, denying any safe place, telling the people of Gaza that go to place X, it'll be safe, and then bombing the route to that place, and then that place. The fact that anyone, the UK, UK representatives and US representatives are denying that this is genocide makes no sense. They are simply looking for continued political alliances with the apartheid regime. They're more interested in profits and power than in international law or human rights. But for someone to say this is not genocide is simply ridiculous. And Israeli spokespeople have said they're going to do the same thing in Lebanon that they've done in Gaza. The people around the world are recognized as a genocide. It's the government, their so-called leaders, who aren't. Throughout the world, repeatedly for the last 13 months, there have been major demonstrations in support of the people of Palestine and calling for an end to this genocide. This information or this knowledge is denied by world leaders.
Iran has warned the EU against imposing more sanctions on the country over unfounded claims that Tehran supplied Russia with ballistic missiles amid its war with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi issued the warning in his ex social media post following reports that the EU is planning to target Iran's shipping lines under the baseless pretext of missile deliveries to Moscow. Araghchi said restrictive measures on Iran's shipping lines would backfire, adding that it would be against the principle of freedom of navigation. The top Iranian diplomat said the EU refuses to reverse the sanctions on Iranian airlines imposed over similar claims that they were involved in transferring missiles and drones to Russia. Araghchi underlined that such behavior towards Iran has no legal, logical, or moral basis. He also reminded that the Ukrainian president himself admitted recently that no Iranian ballistic missiles have been sent to Russia. Political commentator Sarah Flounders says all the sanctions imposed by the US and the EU against Iran are unlawful and in violation of the UN Charter.
Well, first of all of these sanctions from the US and from the EU are illegal. They're unilateral. They're coming only from these countries. They're a violation of international law and the UN Charter in every sense. But really, coming at this moment, they are a cover for what is really happening, and that is that Biden has just authorized Ukraine to use US long-range weapons against Russia, something that was promised would not happen. It would be used only in Ukrainian territory and all of that. So clearly there's U.S. violation of that. There are a very dangerous escalation of the war in Ukraine going on. And so what's the role that the EU is playing? The same role that they're playing in Gaza, same role that they're playing in Lebanon, and that is their heart and soul with this war on the world, war on the people of the world. And so they're charging that Iran is doing sending missiles to Russia. They're also charging that China is sending missiles to Russia.
Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Amir Nasirzadeh has concluded a significant two-day visit to the Syrian capital, Damascus. The trip, followed by high-level meetings, focused on mutual defense plans and the reinforcement of the military cooperation agreements, showcasing the deepening strategic alliance between the two nations. Those were the top stories. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Jenin, Palestinians are forced to rent second homes as their main residences are regularly targeted by the Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Middle East Eye wrote, the Vahdan family's home is regularly targeted by Israeli regime army, and the family, which consists of three generations, has no alternative but to remain in their dwelling. Their building is three stories high and houses 14 Palestinians, seven of whom are children, the oldest being 10 years old. The house is damaged from all sides. The windows are exposed to the elements or covered with plastics. Doors are missing, and the walls are riddled with bullet holes. Inside, burn marks scar the walls, and the electrical system is visibly damaged. Omme Said Vahdan, 57, told Middle East Eye, after the fourth incursion and the repeated targeting of our home, we tried to leave the camp like many others, but we wouldn't, due to high rental costs and landlord fears of renting to families from the camp. Vahdan's three sons are unemployed and barely earn enough to cover their children's daily expenses, and moving out of the camp for their children's safety would mean finding a place large enough for all of them or renting multiple homes, with both options beyond their means. During the camp's longest incursion by the Zionist regime last August, the Vahdan home suffered severe damage, prompting UNRWA, the agency responsible for refugees in the camps, to deem it uninhabitable. The UN agency provided the family with financial assistance to seek alternative housing until repairs could be made. However, according to the family, the 1,300 shekels, over $350, would only cover repairs to the front door and fix the dangerous electrical wiring. According to Vahdan, if the family rented a place outside the camp, they would have no resources left to repair their home and would eventually have to return to it as it is once UNRWA's rental support, which covers just 3 months, ended. Living in an uninhabitable home in a nearby destroyed environment has taken a toll on the children's physical and mental health. They suffer more frequent illnesses and viral infections, and there are the obvious health concerns from drinking contaminated water. As the grandmother explained, "We have not surrendered to our fate, but we have no options to reject this reality. There are no words to describe the terror of a family confined with their children in a single room under shelling and continuous gunfire for 10 days. Under international law, Palestinian camps are primarily the responsibility of UNRWA, with additional organizational oversight provided by popular committees affiliated with the Refugee Affairs Department of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The Palestinian Authority, as the hosting authority for refugee camps in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, also bears partial responsibility. However, with financial crises affecting both UNRWA and the PA, these camps are left vulnerable to unemployment, poverty, and Israeli regime incursions that cause recurring fatalities. Jenin's refugee camp has suffered the most from these incursions, persistent sieges, and economic stagnation, resulting in an extremely high unemployment rate and a steadily rising poverty level. The interventions by UNRWA, the popular committees, or the PA's institutions fall far short of what is required, according to camp residences. Since October 7, 2023, the incursions have damaged around 90 homes in the camp beyond repair, rendered 213 homes temporarily uninhabitable and in need of restoration, and partially damaged dozens more. Mohammad As-Sabbagh, head of the popular committees in the camp, says that the situation is extremely difficult due to the repeated incursions and ongoing destruction of infrastructure. The priority is to repair damage and restore minimal functionality in the camp, rebuild destroyed homes, and to provide one-time partial compensation for the partially damaged homes. Sabbagh told Middle East Eye, "The economic situation is dire. Unemployment in the camp has reached almost 90% or more." He explained that even before the war, Jenin camp residents did not benefit from work opportunities in Israel due to collective punishment measures, which deny them permits. Frequent incursions have worsened the camp's economic situation. Most of the shops on the main streets have been destroyed and daily life is disrupted. Only around 800 people from the camp work within the PA. These factors, combined with limited resources and other priorities for those responsible for the camp and its residents, contribute to a sense of abandonment felt by camp residents. Mary said, "Everyone has left us to face our fate in this camp. No one listens to our suffering."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, hypocrisy. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sister Zainab on A to Z for Iran Radio, And I'm talking a little bit about hypocrisy today. So you all know what hypocrisy means. Imam al-Sada is reported to have said that one who meets Muslims with a double face and a double tongue, on the day of judgment, he will come with two tongues of fire. So it's this very much this image that if we're hypocrites, we are double-faced and we have double tongues. So hypocrisy is something we can see in the way a person behaves. We can hear it in their words as well. So obviously, what this could be is that a person might be, let's say, very, how would we say, maybe we think it's a very pious person. We know they conduct themselves really well in public. They attend all the gatherings. They, you know, they pray, the Jama pray on Fridays. And but then when they're on their own, and I'm just, this is a sort of typical example we hear, it's a sort of stereotypical example, but when they're on their own, when they're not in the public eye, maybe they don't pray their prayers on time, or maybe they're careless with certain things at home. So this is the, and I'll just put another thing out there. So this is, so obviously you can imagine their intention is maybe also not sincere. Because if, look, with hypocrisy, if we have a pure intention regarding our worship with regard to other people, then of course we're going to have the same sort of sincerity with regard to whatever we do in private worship, or in with regard to how we treat people in our lives, as we have then in public with regard to how we treat people. Problematic thing with hypocrisy, with the hypocrites, is that, so you obviously, we've got, I mentioned the double tongue, and this two tongues of fire. So it said to us that obviously when it comes to in the next world, what happens to these people? So it's as if they, obviously they're going to actually, so they're almost being resurrected as beasts, as animals, and they're going to be resurrected. Or let's say we, because we don't know whether this is going to apply to us or not. It depends on whether we've got any hypocrisy in our heart. So let's just say we. So we could be resurrected as this animal that literally has two faces and these two tongues. And we are actually going to be creating this fire, these flames for ourselves in hell, which is quite horrible. So obviously, I've already mentioned just as a very general example. So hypocrisy, we can have hypocrisy in our faith, in our virtues, in righteous deeds, in the rites we perform, in the way we treat other believers. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio with Sister Zainab. And I'm talking a little bit about hypocrisy. So what other things does hypocrisy do? So hypocrisy causes lots of issues in our society. So it's said that it causes things such as discord, sedition, slander. And there's another part to hypocrisy. So hypocrisy is, you know, the way we behave amongst people. Maybe we say good things about them in when we're face to face with them, but you know, we change our attitude when we're somewhere else speaking with others. Hypocrisy can also be very subtle. So I don't know if you're aware that, you know, for example, hypocrisy can also be making gestures about other people. So maybe if we're, let's say we're in a classroom and maybe someone gives an answer to something that we think is not so suitable, we could start to make gestures, winking at someone. So obviously when we're winking at someone, we're probably winking at someone because of something else, or making signals with the eyes even. So just imagine, you could be in a gathering even, and you're maybe someone is you observe someone maybe with not being able to control their kids, so they're gathering with all the women, and someone isn't able to control their little kids so well, and you know, maybe we're just sort of looking across a friend of ours and just winking at them, and you see our intention towards that person is not very good when we behave like that. So what can we do? We need to reflect on this, because we need to get rid of this from our hearts. Allah has said that if we focus on this very consciously, after several days, we could even resolve this issue a little bit, inshallah. So these are just a few little insights for you, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of A to Z. This is Sister Zainab, and fi aman Allah, and farewell. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has called for relations with the European Union to be rebuilt, saying Brexit has undermined Britain's economy. Andrew Bailey also suggested closer ties with the European Union makes economic sense. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The governor of the Bank of England has urged ministers to rebuild relations with the European Union, warning that Brexit has undermined Britain's economy. Speaking at the Mansion House dinner in the City of London on Thursday evening, 14th of November, Andrew Bailey said he took no position on Brexit per se, but added, "I do have to point out the consequences." He said Brexit had weighed on the economy, pointing out in particular the impact of Brexit on Britain's trade in goods. "It underlines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting the decision of the British people," he added. Bank governors traditionally refrain from wading into contentious political issues, but Andrew Bailey's predecessor, Mark Carney, did warn about the potential economic impacts of Brexit before the referendum in 2016. Services exports have performed strongly since the United Kingdom left the European Union, but some goods exporters, especially smaller firms, have struggled with so-called non-tariff barriers such as customs checks. Prime Minister Keir Starmer's government has pledged to deepen cooperation with the European Union, though Brussels has made clear it is unwilling to hold wide-ranging negotiations on trade and cooperation agreement. Labour is opposed to re-entering the European Union's single market or customs union. Instead, the government hopes to win more modest changes, such as mutual recognition of professional qualifications and a veterinary agreement that could alleviate the need for checks on food exports. The Bank of England governor was speaking against the backdrop of Donald Trump's threat of imposing tariffs or import taxes on all foreign goods sold to the United States. Andrew Bailey said he was opposed to this approach, calling himself an old-fashioned free trader at heart. Bailey added, "My point is this, amidst the important need to be alert to threats to economic security, let's please remember the importance of openness." Experts at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research have warned that if Donald Trump goes ahead with his plan for a universal tariff of 10% on all imports, it could cut Britain's growth rate next year to a sickly 0.4%. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, used her speech at the same event, an annual gathering of Britain's financial sector, to praise the City of London, calling it the crown jewel of the UK's economy, and saying post-crash regulation had gone too far. Meanwhile, Britain's Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, has said that there must be no suggestion of Britain going back into the European Union single market or customs union. Mel Stride said the Labour government should be doing everything to facilitate trade, however, with what he said was our biggest trading partner. The Shadow Chancellor was speaking in the wake of weak gross domestic product GDP figures of just 0.1% growth, and comments by Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey on Thursday that Brexit had been a weight on Britain's economy. Chancellor Rachel Reeves said she was not satisfied with the gross domestic product figures, as improving economic growth is at the heart of everything I'm seeking to achieve, she said. Labour MP Liam Byrne said that the country was in a difficult position and that bold measures from government would be needed. Sky News has also covered this same story and tells us more. Brexit has weighed on the British economy and relations with the European Union must be rebuilt, according to the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey. Bailey's comments come in a speech at the City of London's Mansion House on Thursday evening, 14th of November, and were widely trailed beforehand. He said, although he takes no position on Brexit per se, he said, "I do have to point out the consequences. The changing trading relationship with the European Union has weighed on the level of potential supply," he told investors gathered at Mansion House. Britain's Chancellor Rachel Reeves also spoke at the same event. She used her first Mansion House address as Chancellor to criticise post-financial crash regulation, saying it has gone too far, setting a course for cutting red tape. On Brexit, Andrew Bailey said the impact on trade seemed to be more in goods rather than services. "That is not particularly surprising to my mind," he said. "But it undermines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting the decision of the British people." A report earlier this year suggested that Brexit has cost Britain's economy £140 billion so far and could leave us worse off by £311 billion by the middle of the next decade. Prime Minister Keir Starmer has vowed to reset relations with Brussels following a tumultuous period under the Conservatives, but details of what this could look like are vague. European Union nations are reportedly pushing for a youth mobility scheme with Britain, something that the Prime Minister Keir Starmer has ruled out. Starmer has also been adamant that there will be no return to the single market, customs union or freedom of movement. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey's remarks come a week after Donald Trump won the US presidential election, with many economists questioning the potential impact of Trump's proposals to hike tariffs on all US imports. Such a move could put pressure on UK goods prices, contributing to rising inflation, according to experts. It also raises questions about Britain's current trade ties with the European Union. Andrew Bailey also welcomed the Chancellor's spending plans set out in her budget last month, which included £40 billion worth of tax increases to pour cash into schools, the National Health Service, transport and housing.
If you still believe Israel's ever-growing land theft agenda is or will be restricted to Palestine, well, you would be very wrong. Even prior to the creation of Israel on occupied Palestinian land in 1948, the founding father of Zionist fanaticism, Theodor Herzl, had made it crystal clear, quote, Greater Israel would be a Jewish state stretching from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. As the Tel Aviv regime presses ahead with a Nazi-style campaign of genocide in Gaza and a bloody war in Lebanon, remarks by several Israeli officials about the so-called Greater Israel Project have sharply angered the Arab and Muslim nations of West Asia region. Let's take a look at the ambitious Israeli land grab plot in a nutshell. Recently, an Israeli occupation soldier was photographed wearing a uniform patch depicting a map of Greater Israel during aggressions in Gaza, reigniting controversy on social media platforms in Arab countries. The desired map of Israel on the badge encompasses not only the Palestinian territories in their entirety, but also vast swaths of territory from neighboring countries, including Jordan, Lebanon, parts of Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. That's actually what Zionism, which is a fabricated diversion of Judaism, considers as the land promised to the Jews in the Torah. This is while numerous historical and religious studies have demonstrated the falsehood of those claims and distorted interpretations. This interpretation by Zionists has been the subject of controversy since the creation of the Israeli entity in 1948. Zionists see the Greater Israel scheme as the realization of a religious prophecy. Opponents of apartheid, however, believe the project is reminiscent of historical imperial ambitions. Comparisons have also been drawn with Nazi Germany's concept of living space for the chosen race. Despite all the criticism and condemnations of Israel's expansionism, the regime's officials have never shied away from giving publicity to their shameful land grab agenda. In a recent interview, far-right Israeli Minister of Finance Bezalel Smotrich claimed that Israel would expand little by little and eventually encompass all Palestinian territories as well as Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. He had earlier drawn criticism around the world by claiming that there is no such thing as the Palestinian people and that the Palestinian nation was invented only 100 years ago. The likes of Smotrich have openly supported the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, which they believe, like Herzl, that the more Palestinian deaths, the more pieces of land would go under Israel's occupation. Since October last year, when Israel began the bloodshed in Gaza, there have been increasing calls within Prime Minister Netanyahu's far-right cabinet for an occupation of Gaza, blocking of aid to the territory, relocation of Zionist settlers to Gaza, and even the occupation of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Besides attacks on Lebanon, this could indicate that Israel is pursuing goals well beyond Palestine. Observers share the opinion that the Israeli regime's actions revolve around an expansionist project that disregards borders and thrives on the passivity of the international community and the silence of Arab countries that have opted for normalization, wrongly believing that this will shield them from the Zionist regime's aggression. The stark truth is that American-supported Zionism has expanded its sights to include every Arab territory, and that the U.S.-backed Greater Middle East agenda is essentially synonymous with the notion of a Greater Israel. This strategy, recently endorsed by President Biden, a self-proclaimed Zionist, is unquestionably upheld by the American objective to hold a firm foothold in the resource-rich West Asia. For the moment, it seems the steadfast resistance movement put up by Iran and other actors of the anti-Israeli resistance axis in the region has worked effectively to block the realization of Israel's illusions. However, Arab and Muslim countries, especially those whose names are seen on Israel's desired map, need to exercise more vigilance at this critical juncture. Zionists have been assassinating Palestinians and their leaders since before the Israeli regime even invented, when the first group of Zionists began traveling to Palestine to take the land from its original inhabitants in 1881. They began killing those Palestinians who refused to leave their ancestral home. Whether they lived or died, the Palestinians resisted, sometimes with their bare hands, and in so doing, they mocked an Israeli regime that spends and continues to spend billions of dollars on weapons purchases every year. In that proud history of resistance, one Palestinian leader stands out in his life and in his martyrdom. It was his destiny to humiliate the Israelis like few others. In this episode of In a Nutshell, we are looking at the life and death of Yahya Sinwar, the leader of the Palestinian group Hamas. The Israelis had been looking for Yahya Sinwar for an entire year. They used sophisticated spying tools and were aided in the espionage by the United States. They considered him an architect of the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, which had so effectively demolished the standing of the Israeli military and security apparatus. Since that day, Sinwar was a high-priority target for a regime that has forever been in the business of assassinations, the act of practically tiptoeing to your enemy, taking them out and running away. Since that day, Israel had also ratcheted up its atrocity, assassinating other members of Hamas and those of the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. One act of assassination conducted on the territory of Iran, the Israeli regime assassinated Hamas's political chief, Ismail Haniyeh, while he was a guest in the capital, Tehran, to attend the inauguration of Iran's new president. And in another carried out in Lebanon, it murdered the leader of the Hezbollah movement, Saeed Hassan Nasrallah. Sinwar was born in Khan Yunis camp in Gaza in 1962. His family had been forced from their ancestral lands during the 1948 war, in which Zionist militia started an offensive military campaign to take land. He studied Arabic literature at the Islamic University of Gaza and joined efforts to liberate his land from the occupying Zionists. In 1989, he was taken captive by Israeli forces and was held in Israeli captivity for 22 years. He wasn't broken. He committed to learning Hebrew and studying about Zionism in prison. In 2011, he was exchanged along with more than 1,000 other Palestinian captives in return for an Israeli soldier who had been taken prisoner by Hamas. On October the 7th last year, when Hamas fighters overran Israeli watchtowers, checkpoints, reinforced border barriers, and hundreds of almost comically high-tech screening systems to attack Israeli-held land, the Israelis were blindsided as hell. The Israeli military and security and spying services had utterly failed to foresee or stop the attacks. 1,200 Israelis were killed in what became known as Israel's worst day in its memory. A badly humiliated Israel invaded the Gaza Strip where Hamas is based that same day and put Sinwar on its list for assassination, the only thing it could imagine doing against the man. When Israeli secret agents assassinated Haniyeh in Tehran in July 31st this year, Sinwar became the chief of Hamas. They never found them. When he was eventually martyred on the battlefield, it was a chance encounter for the Israelis, and the soldiers who shot the Palestinian hero didn't even know who they were targeting. It wasn't until a day later that they found out. In short footage taken by a drone that was flown into a partially destroyed building during that last encounter, Sinwar is seen masking his face with a Palestinian keffiyeh. His right hand is smashed, he is dazed from bleeding, is out of ammo, and is not even on his feet. But he doesn't surrender. He picks a piece of wood and throws it at the drone. Moments later, an Israeli sniper kills him, and an Israeli tank destroys the floor he is in. At last, the Israeli soldiers who fought with Sinwar didn't even dare enter the building as it was getting dark. They returned the next morning to find out that the man they had been looking for during the entire past year had been right there fighting them on the battlefield. Sinwar outsmarted the Israelis in life and in death. He lived and died a hero.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it? Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the most important Islamic concepts and teachings. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Alavia. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Alavia, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of tawassul. Brother Alavian, let's start with you. What is tawassul?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his purified progeny. Well, tawassul, or resort to the Holy Prophet and Imams, or infallible holy figures, means that you choose a person as a mediator between you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Since he's very close to Allah and he's very near to Allah, you ask him to help you with some of your affairs and some of your issues. This was a quite common belief in Islam world at the beginning and dawn of Islam, and even in the time of other previous prophets, and even at the time of previous prophets as well. Yes. So some people, some believers, actually approach their prophet and they ask him to help them in some issues, since it's very close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All right.
Look, such doubts and misconceptions like tawassul, shafa'a, tabarruk, and concepts and the like, usually, I mean, the core of discrepancy on such issues comes up through one important issue. The ones who are against these concepts believe that the person that you are resorting to, you are actually connecting and approaching, is independent in giving you something.
Mm-hmm.
So all the quarrel is here, all the debate and discussion is here. While we Muslims, believers in the concept of tawassul, believe that this person by himself has nothing. Whatever he has is due to his nearness and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
And he is not independent in giving anything. This is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, this concept was quite common among the believers, among the Muslims. And in the course of history, even the format of this doubt and misconception changed.
All right.
Well, at the first 8th century of Islamic era, so it was quite common.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange to say even four leaders of Ahl Sunnah, Shafi'i, Hanbali, Hanafi, Maliki, all of them were among the people who did tawassul to the, earlier figures like the Holy Prophet and even some of the Sahabas and companions.
All right.
Right. When did it happen? When did this actually doubt come up? At the time of the Ibn Taymiyyah and his students.
All right.
8th century and onward.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, were these previous, scholars, leaders of religions among infidels? Because they came to say, they come up with this idea that all of them are infidels. Whoever believes in them is mushrik. So does it mean that earlier leaders of Islam from both sides, from all Islamic denominations, were among the infidels and mushrikeen? So is it possible to say? So they might say, okay, this is good. Because the format and the concept of tawassul changed in the course of history. Since they came up with, okay, tawassul to the dead ones is not recommended. So if it was so, why some companions at the time of the Prophet, at the dawn of Islam, uncle of the Holy Prophet passed away, based on what Sahih Bukhari says, actually did tawassul to the uncle of the Holy Prophet, Abbas,
mm-hmm.
right? So was it forbidden?
Right.
So why don't we see any objection of, for example, narrators of hadith on that?
Okay.
Again, let's go ahead. Other companions, even prophets before, even at the time of Jacob, Ya'qub the prophet, قال يا أبانا استغفر لنا. That is, they came to their fathers.
Yes.
Oh, father, ask for istighfar, for repentance of us in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Did it mean that they believe that Ya'qub was a prophet?
All right.
Definitely no. So again, the format of tawassul changed in the course of history, and it came to, for example, a new format of it. It is just for the people who are alive. You can do tawassul only to the ones who are alive. So again, a very basic question. If it is so, regardless of this concept of tawassul, why in the salat of, daily prayers, we say, As-salamu alayka ya nabi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So you are doing salam to a person who is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the philosophy of saying salam to? So you mean that this, ahyaun 'inda rabbihim yurzaqun, they are alive. So they might say, okay, this is imaginal body of them.
Yes.
And that is the mithali body of these yes. people that we are talking to. So okay. if they really don't work, I mean, this body doesn't work, so why should we say salam to them? So this salam is, again, useless and has no benefit.
Okay. But Sheikh Rouhani, now the major question is that, is this tawassul only possible to, we can say, the people who are living? Or no, we can do tawassul with the dead ones. I mean, just for example, writing, waiting across or standing across, for example, the tomb of Prophet Muhammad or the Shia'd infallible imams or the, some of the Sahabi, and we can say do tawassul to them. Is it possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We remember that Prophet Yusuf alayhi salatu wasalam sent his clothes to his father Yaqub alayhi salam, and told his father to put this clothing on his eyes and then his eyes will be cured.
Yes.
Look at this piece of cloth. Is it a dead body or a living body?
Even not a body.
Even not a body.
It's a piece of fabrics.
Piece That's of right. fabrics, exactly. Yes. Okay. How can it cure the blind eyes of a prophet like Yaqub?
Can do Even a piece about? Of cloth yes. can save you.
I want to say that when a piece of clothing can cure the eyes of a prophet, while there is no soul, no ruh, no body, no hayat, no life. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to